I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello and welcome to All Stats, Aren't We? A podcast in which Leeds fans cast their combined eye over goings-on at Elland Road, giving scrutiny to the underlying statistics and tactical footings at work at Leeds United. I'm John McKenzie, the Rambo GIF of the podcast, badly judged and boiling piss. And I'm joined by the poet laureate of the podcast, Tom Woodhead, whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. And finally, the Real Sociedad fan reaction of the podcast. Can't wait to see the back of him. It's Darren Driver. Darren, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm very, very well, thank you. Yeah, I enjoyed watching the Twitter tsunami unfold today, John. Thanks for that momentary entertainment in a difficult day. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I wish it had the same alleviative effect on me, but there we go. Tom, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm not too bad. Feeling a lot better.
Good. Right, well, let's get it out of the way. Let's talk about the tap transfer stuff. I don't really know what's going on with Diego Llorente. I think he's kind of our player now. It seems to be generally agreed that he is our player, largely because no one else seems to want him. But should we talk a little bit about Diego Llorente? Anyone got any thoughts on him? I'm sure you have, Darren, as our resident centre-back expert.
Yeah, I mean, his what I would say is from the... I've only kind of had a cursory look, but his... his long passing with his right foot looks really, really good. What he's like in those defensive situations, which always worry me, where people can lose concentration and lose their man. I've heard a few things which I'm going to have to look into, which kind of look a bit concerning to me. But you know, I'll judge him when he's here, like I do with most players. Scouting is not my thing, really. It's just what I leave to you guys.
Mm. In terms of how he's going to fit in. And the logic behind where you see him in the squad. How do you see that?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because we've signed Robin Koch for the right hand side of the defence, and I think Llorente will be in competition with Koch. I don't really think there'll be a kind of an immediate pecking order. I think Koch will play for quite a chunk of the early season just by dint of the fact he was here first and he's got the shirt, but. And I think obviously it gives us a little bit more flexibility when we're going into a three, although that would see Luke Ayling move to the right wing back position rather than the right sided centre half slot, which is where I kind of like to see him. So I think it does afford us that little bit more flexibility and it does give us a bit more cover. It also means that we're not signing a player to compete directly with Pascal Struijk for the left sided centre half slot, which was one of the things I was a little bit worried about when we were looking at Gvardiol. So from that point of view, I'm happy because I think Pascal has done really well when he's been given his chance, and he's a player I'm really keen to see develop.
Tom, what are your thoughts on the whole centre-back situation?
Based on really not that much at all, other than a few breathless runs out of defence, I was really a big fan of the idea of signing Gvardiol. He just looked exciting, and I aesthetically just really like it when defenders run out of defence with the ball. But it's a hard one to gauge, isn't it? Because it does seem like quite a lot of money for someone who may or may not be starting. I'd be really interested to hear someone for, like, I guess Bielsa doesn't normally comment on this kind of thing, does he? But like to hear what the club actually have in mind for this player and what and why they've signed him, because I don't necessarily think it's a bad signing. I mean, he looks like he's a good player, but it's whether is he better than Koch? Is he worse than Koch? Is he about the same level as Koch? I've definitely not watched enough of him to have a good opinion on that. But it gives us options, and it now makes me wonder who's now the first choice backup if Phillips is injured or suspended in that defensive midfield position, because we've now got a lot of defenders who have played in that defensive midfield position before. So I'd be interested to see if Phillips, you know, got injured or suspended, who would play there. Would it be Stroik, because he's done it a few times? Yeah. Would it be Koch, because he played half last season in central midfield? Yeah. Or would it be Llorente, because I know less about this, but I think he has played in that position as well. So I thought that was an interesting thing that got that's raised by, you know, the culmination of signings and Stroik's emergence.
I think that's a really good point, Tom. I think the one thing we will miss that Ben White brought last year was that ability to kind of beat a man under pressure from the back and kind of release us into space a little bit. I think Llorente looks like someone who can carry the ball, but I don't think he's going to be someone who can dribble and create space for midfielders in that same way. So I'd be really interested to see how he fits in. But I'd reserve judgment on him really until I've seen him in the Leeds team.
Yeah, so I've got a few things that I would say to that. Firstly, like, I spent a lot of time watching Llorente play yesterday, and I do think he's a centre-back who's very good on the ball. He will beat on-rushing strikers and get around them. He's not going to dribble in the same way that Ben White does, in the sense that with Ben White, you get the sense that he really wants to penetrate into an opposition midfield. Whereas with Llorente, I got the impression that he's good on the ball, can take it round a player, and then will quickly look to move it on. I saw maybe two or three examples of him actually driving the ball through midfield, but not very many at all. But yeah, I think he's brilliant on the ball. He's very good, like you said, at passing. I think he's got a decent mid-range pass. Like, he's not going to be making line-breaking passes all the time, but he's certainly got that in his locker. He'll be fine, I think, in build-up. He's very, very good aerially, particularly from set pieces in an attacking sense. But he does have this problem, which is that he clearly has fitness issues, and it means he sort of sits a little bit deeper in the back line just to make up for that, which already worries me in terms of, like, if you're going to play in a man-marking system and you need to get, like, 5 yards between yourself and the player that you're marking in order to get a run, that's not going to be ideal. And he's also a little bit Cooperish in that sort of backwards defending when you're running back towards your goal. He got around very easily just because of pace, because he's clearly, like, had injury issues and is a little bit slow off the mark. So yeah, with those things in mind, I think he'll be a fine backup for centre back. But in terms of what we were talking about online today, which is about the logics of these moves, I guess we were talking a little bit about, like, we've gone from a situation where we were told we only needed one centre back. Bielsa didn't want another centre back, to bringing in two centre backs for quite a lot of money in the same position, to challenge for the same position in Robin Koch and Diego Llorente. It's not entirely sure which one will be preferred over the other in a starting sense, but surely this is exactly the sort of situation that we were told Bielsa doesn't want, where he's got players who want to be starting but aren't starting. So how are we going to get around that, Darren?
You threw me a real hospital pass there, John.
Sorry,
it's all right. It's an interesting thought, because throughout my time on this podcast, we've bemoaned the fact that he's been a centre-back short of where we wanted him to be. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to kind of recognise that's now it's seemingly being remedied, and in a sense I'm really pleased about that. But it only puts us in the same position we had last year, in the sense that we had Berardi as backup, and then some younger players around as second or third choices for positions. So
do you not think the emergence of Stroik as a first team player changes that?
I guess it does. But from the clips that I've seen of Llorente at left centre back, he really doesn't look as comfortable as he does on the clips that I've seen of him where he's playing on the right. So I think.
Now, what I'm saying is, you were saying that we look like we're at the same position we were, like when we were bemoaning the lack of a third centre back. But we have one who's emerged from the youth team now to be a first team player. So that is an extra player.
True, but when we had three centre backs last year, we were saying we wanted a fourth one. So, which I kind of. Is a position that I sort of stay with, that, albeit we have been told all along that Bielsa doesn't want that extra player sitting around. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see how we manage that. And as you say, the two centre backs that we're signing are two of the three most expensive centre backs we've signed in our history. So somebody's going to have their nose put out of joint in all likelihood, and I think it's going to be really interesting to see how that's managed, particularly some of the stuff I've been reading around Llorente's personality, where he's kind of, I think there was a kind of sense that he was at Sociedad until he could get to a bigger club, so he's clearly got kind of quite a high opinion of himself on that level. So it'd be really interesting to see how he takes, you know, really having to fight for his place, possibly sitting on the bench for half a season.
Pontus Llorente.
Yeah, well, we should mention the Rodrigo de Paul saga as well, because, and again, something that I talked about today, I should own this, is that I don't understand the logic to a lot of what we're doing in the transfer market. And that does, now, I want to be clear from the start that that doesn't mean to say that I think that these are bad signings. I probably worded a few tweets badly today that people just sort of think that I'm saying that these signings aren't particularly good. I don't think that's true. What I mean when I talk about the logics of the signings is potentially, well, primarily to do with what it makes the whole squad look like. And I feel like just looking at the squad now and the signings that we've made, I feel as though we've not solved problems. We've just sort of created other problems in different areas. So Rodrigo Moreno, we've seen that he has to play basically as a striker. I don't think he's going to necessarily work as a 10. I don't think you'll necessarily get the best out of him on the right. So the question then is, like, how do we see him fitting in a team with where Bamford is going through probably what is the form of his life at the moment? Are we just going to sort of keep him as a backup just in case Bamford goes off the boil? And then when it comes to Robin Koch and Diego Llorente, to me, it just sort of feels like we've signed the same. It seems like we had two options and we've signed both of them. And I think I would rather have had one of those two as a sort of starting centre-back. And then I would have liked a younger backup player. And that's why we were all excited about Gvardiol, because you don't have that issue of having to start him every week. You can slowly bring him through. And then if he turns out being better than one of the other two centre-backs or the other centre-back, then you can simply replace him. And now we have a situation where we have two centre-backs of, I would say, probably about the same level. And again, fair enough, we will be playing three centre-backs times this season. We probably will be this weekend. Yeah. But that doesn't mean to say that you don't create a problem in trying to work out which one of those two is going to take priority over the other and still have to manage that. So, and then when it comes to Rodrigo de Paul, the underlying issue that I see is that we seem to have these sort of unattainable transfer options who are like, this is the ideal that we want to sign, and then we spend a lot of time trying to sign those players. So Ben White, for example, and then as soon as that falls through, we jump immediately to buy just any, it seems like, anyone. No doubt we have a shortlist, but it feels like there's a number of steps between going from someone like Ben White to then going to someone like Robin Koch, and someone like Gvardiol to then going to someone like Llorente. Now, those players have very, very different profiles. They're very different age profiles. And so I guess when I talk about players having different profiles, I kind of mean, well, when you're drawing up a shortlist, you want to be saying, what are the things that we're looking for? Here are five players that fit within that. And it just seems as though we're jumping around a little bit. Same with Rodrigo de Paul. It now seems that that's going to be unattainable. It's not going to happen. And we're just sort of like scattergunning a little bit around Europe, trying to find creative-ish midfielders in Italy or in Spain and try and bring those in. And so I guess my issue with the logics isn't so much saying that we don't need the players that we've got. I just kind of think in terms of the broader squad, we need to be thinking longer term and have a little bit more of a process behind it. Now, that's not to say there isn't a process behind it, but for me on the outside, I struggle to see that. But so that's just by way of clarification. But I've said a lot of things there, Tom. What's your immediate response to that stuff?
Yeah, I guess regarding Cock specifically, we know that Leeds have been monitoring Cock for a long time, and Orta was talking about him round about this time last year, actually, in an interview that he did, where he was saying, this is a player that we can't get now because we're in the Championship, but if we get promoted, then this might be a player we can get. So I think he was always going to be high on the shortlist for that reason alone. He's a player we've been looking at for a long time. I sort of understand to a certain extent why they wouldn't be able to go for a player with the profile of Ben White, because there aren't any, really. Like, yeah, I mean, we did go for one, Gvardiol. Like, we tried to get Gvardiol, and that is a player who, you know, does... runs out with the ball from the back a lot. And I remember very early on in the window, we got linked with him. I can't remember the guy's name, but a centre-back from Lazio. And there may well have been nothing in that, but he seemed a similar player to White as well. I think a Brazilian centre-back from Lazio. I can't remember his name. So I think it's just hard. It's really hard to replace a player like Ben White because he's not similar to many other players. You don't get that many centre-backs who are quite so prodigious with their dribbling and with their stepping into midfield, I don't think. So I don't give the club a free pass on that, but I understand why it might be difficult to look for another player of that sort of profile. Regarding the midfield thing, yeah, I probably don't have enough insight into those other players to like really understand what's going on there. So I'll defer to people who know more about it than me.
Yeah, the centre-back was Luis Felipe.
That's the guy, yeah.
Yeah, and I think you make some good points there. I wonder whether or not you would agree with this. My sort of theory, and it is just a sort of a cooked up theory, is that we go for the player that Bielsa really wants, and then when that player doesn't turn out to materialise, we then go for someone who Orta wants. It just seems to be the way that the logic seemed to be going on this one. So I don't know if there's any logic to that.
It's a depressing theory, but it does sound like it could be true.
As I understand it, though, Bielsa wanted to sign Llorente when he was at Lazio, so maybe this is the one that they've given to shut Bielsa up moaning about him.
Yeah, it could be.
That's true, because, I mean, yeah, Cock definitely seems like an Orta pick.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is like, when Bielsa was at Lazio, I think Diego Llorente would have been a great signing. I don't think, no one has any problem with that sort of idea that he's a great player. The thing that worries me is he's another player who's had injury issues. Yeah. And if you look at his underlying numbers, they are dwindling in the last few seasons. And the question is whether or not that's just a sort of temporary blip because of various things off the pitch, or whether or not those injuries have had a long-term effect on his profile. And like, again, that's a risk that you take, but we're paying a lot of money for that risk. I mean, we paid 18 million for Rio Ferdinand. Like, and I think that's obviously it's a long time ago, but it's a lot of money to be spending for a quote unquote backup centre back or third choice centre back or whatever we want to call it.
I suspect that Bielsa is an eternal optimist, isn't he? And I suspect that he probably thinks that almost every single player we sign could be made into one of the best players in the world.
And I think it should be mentioned as well, and I mentioned this on the Twitter account as well, that, you know, Marcelo Bielsa hasn't had a club or a squad to work with for more than 2 years. And that means that largely the players that he's made great are players who've already been there. Now, that's not to say that we could sign some bang average players and then they turn out to be really good. I think that's probably true. But at the same time, I don't think that we should therefore just sort of aim to buy whoever we can get and just hope that Bielsa can make them good. I think that our recruitment process should be a little bit more complex than that. And the other thing is as well, just because Bielsa obviously is one of the greatest coaches in the world, that doesn't mean to say he's one of the greatest recruiters in the world. And the thing that kind of annoys me about the Radrizzani regime at the moment is that he started off with this sort of tripartite system he cooked up, where we were going to have Victor Orta as head of recruitment and Angus Kinnear as the CEO, and then the coach was going to be very much working in tandem with those. And at the moment it feels very much like that tripartite system just is heavily lopsided towards Bielsa, which is fine. Like, obviously you give deference to Bielsa, but the problem is, as we always say, when Bielsa leaves, and we don't know when that will be, What's the state of the squad going to be like at the end of that? And I guess that's what's always at the back of our mind, is that you can't just constantly have Bielsa digging you out of holes with respect to your squad or whatever, because at some point he's going to go, and we don't want to end up in a position where we just sort of collapse a little bit after that happens.
I'm going to collapse a little bit after that happens.
Yeah, me too.
Well, we all are, of course. Yeah. Oh, anyway, now that with the depressing stuff is out of the way, we should talk a little bit about the Sheffield United game. So this week I had the pleasure of talking to Anthony Adshead of S2 Stats, and this is what he had to say. Anthony, hi, how are you doing?
Yes, not bad, John. How are you?
Yeah, not so bad. You recovered from the ignominy of last night. Wasn't the greatest result for you guys after the early red card?
This is true. It wasn't the greatest result. I'm kind of recovered. I'm having to be philosophical. But I gather from the questions that you'll ask me, you'll get an answer to that question in more length as we go on.
So it's your second season in the Premier League. How are you feeling about it at the outset?
Well, on the surface of things, not massively great so far. Having lost two games out of two in the league. But at the same time, arguably, both of them have been perhaps uncharacteristic, in that last night, obviously, there was the red card. And then against Wolves, a crazy first 6 minutes in which we were two down before very long. And you know, that just made things all the more difficult from there. So I don't think necessarily that the results so far are representative of what we will expect over the season.
Do you think that Sheffield United are going to be underestimated this season off the back of these first two results?
Off the back of those, it's possible that we could be underestimated. I would have guessed on the whole that we may well have been overestimated, perhaps to some extent based on last season's performance. Although, obviously, we're going to come on to transfers in a bit. We haven't set the transfer market alight and aren't able to with the money that we've got. So that may have downplayed a lot of people's expectations.
Last season, the underlying figures probably flattered Sheffield United last season. Does that worry you going into this season?
I'm not sure I totally agree with the premise of the question there, in that at least with one figure, which is the defensive record, United were very good. Until the restart after the lockdown, I think we were the second best in the league in defensive terms after Liverpool. Things went a bit awry after the restart, and I think we ended up fourth best in the Premier League in terms of defence. So, and even looking at what happened last night, I mean, there was the red card. We were 10 men against a Villa team that spent 190 million over the summer. And for the most part, did a very good job. And I think that's, you know, probably one of the key strengths of the Sheffield United team that we can look forward to. Also, I mean, I think that we'll come on to this when it comes to differences between Sheffield United and Leeds United as we go on. I think that another figure that's kind of on the low end with Sheffield United is the amount of shots we had last season. And we are at the low end of things there in terms of the Premier League. But I think that the way that Wilder plays the game, sets things up, and the way he's played things from the start, I think it tends towards quite a good deal of efficiency in terms of the result you get from those shots. But we'll come back to that type of thing when we talk about how we play.
How was the summer for you? Are you happy with where the squad has ended up?
Well, there you go. I'm umming and ahhing straight away. Yes and no. I mean, I think Ramsdale is a pretty reasonable replacement for Henderson. Fodderingham's obviously in there as a backup keeper. The two young fellas from Derby. I didn't get to see the Carabao Cup game last week, but I gather they're quick and lively and good footballers, but we haven't seen them come into the team yet. Oliver Burke does look very good. Just his one little contribution last night showed the pace he got and the nous to to deal with, to get the ball through four Villa defending players for what became the missed penalty chance. And Ethan Ampadu is obviously just a very accomplished footballer, and I suspect we'll talk more about him as we go on through the podcast here. So, you know, I think, you know, what we're actually looking for is a bit more pace up front, and Ollie Burke provides that, but I'm pretty sure that Wilder wants more.
Despite bringing players in over the summer, in the Premier League at least, you've stuck to last season's starting 11 for the most part, or at least players that you had last season. Which of the new players do you expect to break into the side in the next few months?
I would expect Ampadu to get in there, and he might get in there sooner rather than later. We're going to have to talk about what Chris Wilder will do in the wake of John Egan getting a red card. I don't know what that means in suspension terms. I'm not sure if it's one or two and whether it's served straight away, but Ampadu could be one of the replacements that goes in there straight away. Oliver Burke, I think he is very, very likely to be straight in as a replacement in terms of the rotation for the forward line.
This season, Ollie Norwood has been replaced by Sander Berger in the sort of more deep-lying role in the midfield. Do you think this is a good move by Wilder? Do you think it will stick? Is this going to be something that we see on a regular basis?
I think it could stick because Sander Berger is a great player. Hmm. I think it might not stick necessarily because Ollie Norwood is also a great player and he does things that Berger doesn't, and Berger does things that Ollie Norwood doesn't. It's always been a bit of a puzzle to me exactly where Berger's going to fit when you've got a player like Ollie Norwood that's so good and has been so instrumental to Sheffield United since he's been here. But it's also been one of those things that Chris Wilder has always seemed to have done since he's been here, which is to bring in players that are pretty obvious replacements for players that are already there. Obviously, to some extent, that's to create competition. But it also creates, and it must create, a hell of a headache for him and Alan Neil in terms of selection. So I think Berger's great. He could do the job if Ollie Norwood wasn't there. But Ollie Norwood is also a fantastic player.
Let's talk about the tactics. Obviously, tactically, a lot has been made of Chris Wilder's 3-5-2, especially the overlapping centre-backs. But I think it's unfair to reduce his tactical nous to that particular outlier. Could you talk us through the basic system that Sheffield United play?
Yeah, sure. So it is essentially a kind of 3-5-2. I mean, there might be, they're obviously, you know, in reality, it doesn't necessarily always sit like that. Quite obviously, too, you know, if we're defending, it drops back to a 5-3-2, or even sometimes it looks more like a 4-4 something something, which I think has more balance. The overlapping centre backs thing, I don't think there's any rocket science to it. You know, some people, you know, say, oh, well, you know, by rights, in theory, you should get absolutely smoked on the counter. That doesn't happen because generally, and it has been, Ollie Norwood has been the one to stay back. So if Jack O'Connell goes forward, or if Chris Basham goes forward, there's a midfielder sitting in there to take their place. I think the thing that possibly does escape people's notice if they're more casual observers is that I think that what we see a lot of at United when we're playing on the front foot is what you might call a kind of high wide overload, in that a lot of play will take place in the kind of, you know, in that final third and on the flanks, a lot of passing around, overloading by our midfield against the opponent's midfield, and the aim is to try and create balls into the box that are going to do some damage. Not just any ball, not just slinging things in, but trying to get balls into the box that are kind of precise. Now that hasn't always been possible in the Premier League. It was something that massively characterised Sheffield United in the Championship and below. It's become less easy to do as we've found out in the Premier League. And early last season, there was a real evolution. which I know you were going to ask me about, actually, and that was the thing. I think early on, Chris Wilder and Alan Neil tried to play the same as they had done in the divisions below, pushing the opponents back against into their final third, and playing a lot of passes around, trying to get the right ball in. Now, that just, I mean, we could see it happen early last season against experienced and very competent Premier League defences. You just couldn't do it. You know, these guys would sit there all day long and just bat away anything that came in. So a lot, what tended to happen was that we've gone to becoming, in some circumstances, more of a counter-attacking team. And that relates back to the transfers that we were talking about earlier, that at the forward end of the pitch, in that what we need is speed. There are times when, or there have been times when, Chris Wilder has brought out Billy Sharp to play, but that tends to be only ever against sides that are going to sit back in around their own box. But it won't be against a lot of the other teams, where we need to kind of make up that space very rapidly between our defending in our half and getting into the opponent's box.
So Bielsa and Wilder have faced off against each other within recent memory. How do you think Wilder will approach the Leeds game? Do you think the fixtures will play out similarly, or do you think there will be a difference to them?
The most memorable recent one for me was the one at Leeds that kind of, you know, obviously that's memorable because it kind of really helped cement our promotion. And that was very much a situation similar to the type of situation I've just alluded to, in that we played Leeds intending to soak up Leeds pressure and get some opportunities on the break. And that's what happened, and that's what panned out, and, you know, it succeeded. I wouldn't be surprised to see quite a bit of the same happen again. I think that we would expect to soak up quite a bit of Leeds pressure. I think Leeds have already shown, without being too familiar with the real details of how you play, I think Leeds have already shown that, you know, their goals against Liverpool, for example, Leeds have shown that they're very capable of pressing, very capable of moving the ball around themselves, very capable of pressing an opponent high and creating chances. Although there were fewer chances than one might expect against Liverpool for Leeds. So I would expect that Sheffield United would expect to get pushed back by Leeds for some of the game. Having said that, I also think that, and there might be a kind of a way that Sheffield United play that utilises kind of phases of, you know, if we're pushed back, we'll sit back and we'll try to play on the break. If the ball's in a certain part of the pitch, in the sort of final two-thirds of the pitch, I think we will attack the opposition and try to create things. And in those situations, I think you can see the push high, play on the flanks, try and work the ball into good positions in the box type play. So I've probably given you a really woolly answer there, but I think we'll play on the break when we have to. I think we'll push up against Leeds when we can. I don't know how to say much more than that without sounding as if I'm trying to cover all the bases.
Do you think the Leeds fixture offers you a good benchmark for how far you've progressed in the Premier League, given the two teams were fairly evenly matched in that season where you got promoted?
It's hard to say. I don't know, because I don't know what Leeds are going to be like in the Premier League. You could do really well. You could be really leaky. Leeds could be, as I say, you got chances against Liverpool, but in actual fact there weren't that many, and you had quite a high success rate in terms of the shots you did have. So I don't know quite what Leeds are going to be like yet. I don't know if Leeds can. I think they might have to learn in the way that Sheffield United did, that they can't necessarily play in the same way as they did in the Championship. You know, the number of goals going either way at the moment might indicate that that could be the case. So it's always hard, you know, is there a good benchmark? I would only judge things over a range of games against different opponents. Sorry, another woolly answer, another bunch of caveats. But, you know, just playing Leeds doesn't tell me everything I need to know.
Obviously, John Egan got sent off this week against Villa. You've already suggested that maybe Eze and Ampadu will be brought in. Is there much of a selection headache for Wilder there?
I don't know exactly whether Ampadu would be the replacement. He could be. One of the other centre-backs could shift over. Basham could shift over, or O'Connell could shift over. But having said that, they're the kind of attacking options. He could put Ampadu... I must say that, just point out that John Egan is the stay-at-home centre-back of the three of them. So anybody that replaces Egan is going to be probably in the stay-at-home role. So there is Phil Jagielka, who obviously, while not young and therefore less mobile, is suited to the stay-at-home role. And obviously got a great deal of nous. You know, there might have been a certain level of intelligence up top that may not have got him into that situation yesterday against Villa. Who knows? So I think Egan's got options. You know, I think Chris Wilder's got options in the form of Jagielka and or Ampadu for this position.
So apart from that, how do you expect the Blades to line up on Sunday?
I think the key area where there could be any changes, and I don't necessarily think there need to be, is in the kind of the more central midfield three. In other words, Ollie Norwood could come back in. That could mean that Sander Berger's on the bench, or it could mean that Sander Berger replaces Lundstrom. Up front, I would expect either the two Ollies, namely Burke and McBurney, to start, or possibly, like last night, Ollie Burke and David McGoldrick.
And which players do you think will need to perform well if you're to get a result against Leeds?
So the obvious answer is all of them. but in particular, I'm very confident, even after last night, that our defensive play is pretty solid, that we can do a good job there, and that if we are pushed back by Leeds, that we will frustrate them. I noticed Villa last night had something like 18 shots, and it was only a very small amount of those were on target. So where I think that Sheffield United really need to perform in ways that they possibly haven't so far is in that the more creative end of things, which is John Fleck breaking things up and, all of the midfield 3/5. It's those that really have to be on top form and, you know, breaking things up, creating things, creating chances.
You've said that you're a fan of woolly answers. I don't ask for predictions, so you'll be happy to hear that. But I do ask, how do you expect the game to go in terms of the flow of it?
Lots of pushing high from Leeds. Some attacks on the counter from Sheffield United. There will also be some periods where we break up Leeds' play and create higher, more sustained chances. I think... Overall, though, you know, just in terms of blind predictions, it's possibly the time that Sheffield United are going to get a better result. It's simple. It just would be awful unlucky to lose 3 on the bounce. I don't think it'll happen. I hope it won't happen. but I can't really say more than that.
Well, Anthony, thank you so much for coming on. Hopefully you'll be able to enjoy the game on Sunday.
Yeah, hopefully we'll do. So thank you, John. Thanks for having me on. And if anybody wants to check my stuff out, I'm on Twitter at S2Stats. Not a great deal on there so far this season, but the stats work will be ramping up as we get stuck into things after a few games.
Well, thanks very much.
Okay, John. Thanks very much.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So that was Anthony Adshead of S2 Stats. Darren, what did you make of that?
Well, first of all, I absolutely cannot believe that Phil Jagielka is still playing. That was my first takeaway from it. And the other thing that really kind of struck home with me was the idea that Sheffield United will try and really take advantage with width. And I think that certain points of the Fulham game showed that we will struggle if teams are able to get in behind our centre-backs and if they're able to overload the full-back areas, particularly the left-back area, then I think we may run into some problems. But overall, I sort of feel like it'll be a game where, much more like our Championship games, where we're kind of pushing on and really playing on the front foot. Just from the things he said, I don't see a huge amount of development in the Sheffield United tactical plan or team at all.
Tom, what's your gut response to what you just heard?
Yeah, the overriding thing that I got from it as well was all the talk about width. And it's basically two teams that like to play at the sides of the pitch, isn't it? So it's going to be interesting to see what happens with the middle of the pitch, because paradoxically, that's probably where it's going to be won, even though both teams are going to be attacking the sides. So, I'm interested to see how much Sheffield United have changed since we last played them, because I only watched them a little bit last year, and my perception, even during the year that Sheffield United got promoted and we missed out, was that they got more and more pragmatic as the season went on. They, at the start, they were a lot more attacking, and towards the end of the season, they did an incredibly good job of scoring a goal and then becoming a bit more defensive and being incredibly solid. And talking about that width, the main difference that, as I see it, and it could well be bollocks, is that we attack wide and we defend wide, and we attack and they attack wide but they defend narrow. They try and stop people from going through the middle, like, and we have to defend wide because our defensive structure is the opposition's attacking structure effectively. So, you know, they can afford to funnel opponents into a narrow space, and we can't do that because we're man marking.
Yeah, that's interesting. I watched back our home game against Sheffield United from 18-19 season, and it was really, really interesting actually. It's well worth doing actually, watching a sort of game that you think that you remember, and then it turns out you don't remember. One of the things I didn't remember about that game, interestingly, this is just completely tangential, but was Kiko Casilla gets sent off at the end, and Pablo Hernandez is desperate to go in goal.
And then Pontus goes in, does he?
Yeah, Pontus goes in because his knee's buggered. Yeah. But that, I think that's the only thing that stops Pablo from going in. And it's just so funny because I think he might even have the shirt on at one point. And he just looks absolutely tiny. That was a funny aspect of it. But you're right. I think your instinct is right that they were very pragmatic in the sense that they sort of hit back, that they sat back and they sort of tried to hit us, decompress quite quickly, using width. The way they use width is really fascinating. Everyone goes on about their overlapping fullbacks, centre backs, and obviously that's kind of interesting. But it's the fact that they're able to get sort of three players into wide areas and then move their central midfielders across. So they're very good at overloading on either side, which obviously we do too. But they're a lot more balanced in that. They can overload on either side and can cause problems from there. It's definitely going to be an interesting match from the point of view of the man marking system, because I always think a 3-5-2 is quite a tricky one for us to deal with in terms of our structure, but we'll talk about that in a little bit. Before we get to that, Tom, how do you feel about the fact that if Liverpool was a free hit and Fulham was a must win, how do you feel about this game? What is the nature of this game and how should we be approaching it?
It's the first normal game, isn't it? It's the first regular Premier League game that it could go either way. Well, I mean, Fulham could have gone either way, but it feels like, okay, these are the meat and potatoes games, and it's in games like this that make the difference between 17th and 10th. So it feels like every single game I've got a new reason to be nervous, and this is just the third of many.
Yeah. Darren, you're not a man to feel nervous about these things, so please give us some positivity before this game.
It's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. I mean, whether we win, lose or draw, it'll be fine because, you know, I approach these things mindfully. Mm. I think that ultimately, you know, we will go into this game with a lot of confidence. I think we'll be playing an opponent that although they do break into wide areas and try to do so quickly, I don't think they're the most dynamic team we're ever likely to face. I think they will play to much the same tactical plan that they did in the Championship, albeit, as you said, with a bit more of a kind of defensive edge. So I feel like we can go into the game with a lot of confidence, and ultimately it'll be the same Bielsa approach as it always is, which is we're going to go there and we're going to try and win, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Do you feel good about the fact that we've already played Sheffield United under Bielsa? Do you think that gives us maybe a bit more of an edge than it might do against other comparative teams to Sheffield United in the division?
Possibly. I mean, I think obviously we've experienced the overlap in centre-back routine before. And in fact, one of those overlapping centre-backs was the player that scored against us, if I recall correctly. It was Chris Basham, wasn't it? Mm. So I think that might give us some insight, but ultimately I know that he will have done his research on the Sheffield United of today and not be relying on the information that he got 2 years ago, so I think it might make a marginal difference, but overall it's the scouting work and the research work that he'll be doing right now that will see us right.
I think it makes more of a difference the other way around, in my opinion. I think Wilder's got a bit of a chip on his shoulder about Bielsa. As much as I think Wilder's a really good manager, he seemed really upset in the season they got promoted about not getting as much credit as Bielsa, despite the fact that he won LMA Manager of the Year or whatever it was. And I think I don't know how that'll affect his preparation for the game, but I wouldn't be surprised if it affected it in some way. Like he's telling his players, listen, you know, we're not going to have this guy beating me because, you know, everyone thinks he's great and we don't get any credit, blah, blah, blah. So I'd be interested in that.
It could also work the other way in the sense that I think a lot of other clubs in the Premier League are just going to be completely blown out of the water, at least in the first match that they play us, by the man-marking system, because so few teams actually play that sort of system regularly. I know that Jurgen Klopp made a point about it in some of the pre and post-match interviews that he did, whereas obviously Sheffield United have played against us twice. They know exactly what to expect. They've largely got the same teams that played against us, so I'm sure they'll be ready for us. I've already mentioned the tactical elements to it, and I've said that I feel like this is going to be a battle around the structure, and we've talked at length this week again on the Twitter account about the fact that the basic blueprint for Bielsa is having a plus one superiority, so a man over at the back and then a man less, a minus one inferiority at the front. I think that's all well and good, but the question that raises is how do you look at this game formationally? Tom, how do you expect us to line up? Are we going to go with a back three, or do you think we'll try a 4-1-4-1?
I think every time Bielsa has started with a 4-1-4-1 against two strikers, he's always said afterwards that he's regretted it. I never like it because it does seem to leave us really exposed at the back when we do that, especially in build up. So, but I guess the question is, if we do go for a 3-3-1-3, he doesn't seem to like to change the personnel to do it. So, you know, do you know what I mean? He doesn't like changing who's in the team to accommodate the new formation. So it's a question of who would play where. And I'm not sure we have anyone in the current lineup who would play right wing back, because Ayling would presumably go to third centre back. And then, yeah, who plays on the right wing back? So I guess it depends whether he considers that shape to be more important or whether he considers the personnel that have been playing to be more important.
It's a funny one, because watching back the game against Sheffield United at Elland Road again, it was weird, because it almost seemed as though we were playing a 4-1-4-1. Luke Ayling played as the sort of outside centre back on the right, but also Alioski just sort of looked like a left back who was maybe a little bit further forward. Luke Ayling wasn't scared to go forward as the right centre back, and we basically played Pablo Hernandez on the right, and you know he's not a wing back in any sense of the word really. So it may simply be the case that, you know, he'll play the personnel that he wants to play, and then we'll sort of shift into that 3-3-1-3 as naturally as we possibly can. I'm with you. It's hard to know. It's hard to know with the right back situation or the right wing back situation what he'll do.
Yeah, I think especially last season, Luke Ayling was more and more often as the season went on playing as a sort of hybrid centre back / right back. Even in games where we were playing four at the back, I think like he would come. They would make a sort of back three at certain points in build-up, not the very start, but like the bit just after the start when Phillips steps up again. Mm-hmm. Ayling would quite often come into a sort of slightly advanced third centre-back position, and then he'd go off on his big runs. So I guess the longer that you play these tactics, the less that the specific formation matters, because you can introduce more subtleties and sophistications to it.
Yeah, I think Bielsa must be of the opinion that he sort of has his personnel. They sort of know what roughly positionally they're playing, and he'll say to them, for example, to Calvin Phillips, look, we're going to have one of our fullbacks dropping in on one of the center forwards, so we're going to be a little bit like a back three, so you're going to have to cover in the fullback areas on either side of that, so just keep an eye on that. And you're still sort of playing the same system, but the structure is just sort of situational. The players won't be thinking of it in terms of those numbers, they'll be thinking of it in terms of the roles that they're playing.
Yeah, I'm sort of wondering though whether he might bring Alioski to play the left wing back role, given how well he did against Fulham, and also to kind of give a bit of additional cover on that side and move Dallas over to that right wing back slot. I think that's probably the way that I would want to see it go, I think, if anything. But it'd be really interesting to see.
It makes logical sense to me. I can't remember a time when we've actually seen him change the personnel to play three at the back. There may well be a time, but I can't think of one.
Well, we were largely doing that at the end of last season, right? I'm just thinking, like, when we played 3-3-1-3 at the end, this is what impressed me so much with watching back that Sheffield United game from the season before last season, was that we were playing 3-3-1-3 completely differently to the way that we play it now. And that is because we had sort of Pablo as a floating wing back. Whereas after that point, and this started in the pre-season last season against Cagliari, when we played Adam Forshaw as the right wing back, and he sort of pretty much functioned as a centre midfielder in a sort of double pivot. And then you have that central midfielder who then gives a bit of cover for the right back. So Luke Ayling can go forward. He also is able there to help out in the build-up play because he gives you another option. So I think I'm with Darren in that I think that we will see Stuart Dallas play to the right of Calvin Phillips, and then we may even see Leif Davis weirdly as a left wing back, because we saw him in that Cagliari game as well, although he has been playing him as a centre back in games obviously. But I think Leif Davis is the safer option for me than Alioski. Alioski, obviously is easy to be a detractor of, but he's been very, very good coming off the bench with 20 minutes to go, because he's just the ultimate presser. And I would rather have him in that scenario than, oh shit, he's made a mistake in the left back position and we're going to concede. I would much rather he came on and just ran around a lot and caused a lot of problems. So if I was pushed, I'd probably do that. Maybe we'll see Barry Douglas as the left wing back, but again, it's hard to know what's going on with him.
I guess the other possibility is we have seen at times Harrison basically having the entire left wing to himself.
Yeah.
And as far as I know, Sheffield United tend to attack more down the left than down the right. So that might make some kind of sense to overload the right on our side a bit and then just have Harrison looking after the left on his own.
And then what do? You have Costa going across on the left and then Hernandez on the right?
Hernandez is going to be out, I think.
He's definitely out.
We don't know that, do we?
I thought I'd seen a thing where I think either Graham or Phil had reported that they're expecting him to be out for the weekend as well.
Right, okay. That certainly makes it interesting. So that would suggest that Harrison will have to play as the left winger then, because we don't really have any other
wingers. No, I mean, what I'm talking about is when we don't play a left winger. There was quite a few times last season when we didn't play a left winger at all. Well, we did. It was Harrison, but he also played left back. Like, this happened 3 or 4 times last season, where we just had Harrison covering the entire left wing to himself. We had the right wing, like, with an extra player, essentially.
Yeah. I'm just trying to think of those situations, because there was, I know that we did it occasionally. We tried out a 3-5-2 a couple of times. I know we did it against, I think, Salford, and we also tried it against Brentford, because we were trying to get Bamford and Nketiah in the same team.
Yeah.
I think it's mostly been when Dallas is playing this. Well, there was the times when we played the 3-5-2, but
yeah,
there were a few times when Dallas played almost essentially. He was at left back occasionally, but he spent more time on the right wing than the left
and
wing.
And then Calvin Phillips can drop in into that space as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure that's an option as well. But then I guess that means that we're going to have Tyler Roberts or Rodrigo or...
Probably none of these things will happen, right?
Yeah, we've not mentioned Shackleton, to be fair. Shackleton is, I think, the perfect player to play as that sort of shuttling right wing back.
Yeah, I agree.
No, yeah, that's a good shout.
But again, like, we have no idea what will happen.
Well, I think we're more likely to see Alioski and Dallas than we are to see Shackleton, just because he seems to implicitly trust Alioski to start games and to play more minutes, whereas Shackleton seems to be in the 5-10 minutes at the end sort of range at the moment. So, yeah.
Yeah, I guess it all depends on like whether or not he's happy playing Dallas in that right wing back position and then using one of the other left backs.
Yeah.
But yeah, it'll certainly be interesting in that respect. The other question then is, given that we've talked about the -1 inferiority against a back three, is going to be, how is the high press going to work? I did the video last week, at the video analysis of the Fulham game, and it almost looked like we were trialing out a little bit of a new press using, because obviously Rodrigo played in the central midfield position and Bamford played as well, and they sort of did this sort of shuttling V-shaped press where they would both end up either marking Harrison or the opposite centre back to, sorry, Harrison Reed or the opposite centre back to Harrison Reed. And we saw it happening a few times where both players ended up tight on Harrison Reed and not marking the centre back. And I wondered whether or not, you know, a similar thing might be happening. And that was partly because Fulham had their centre back so far apart. It just wasn't worthwhile. Bamford just headless chickening backwards and forwards between the centre backs, and I wonder whether or not we'll do something similar with the three, if we have Bamford going towards one and then one of the eights pushing on the opposite sided centre back when the ball goes back across the back three. I don't know if anyone had any other thoughts on that.
Yeah, the other thing I wondered is whether the whether Costa and Harrison might alternate in terms of picking up that side of the press and make it into a kind of lopsided 3-5-2, which is situational depending on which way the ball's going.
Yeah, and I think that's definitely happened before in the past, right?
Yeah, and that was the one thing I was thinking when you were saying, Tom, about playing Harrison on the left all on his own. I think that would preclude him from doing that situational press.
Hmm. Right, let's get on to start talking about the actual game itself then. So I always ask this question because I'm interested, but which players do you think Leeds are going to have to have put in a good performance if they're going to get anything out about against Sheffield United? Who are the players that we're really looking forward to turn it on? We'll start with you, Darren.
Whoever plays in the creative eight role, I think, is going to have to really kind of kick it up a notch from where we've been so far. So whether it's Rodrigo Moreno or whether it's Tyler Roberts, and I suspect it will be either, you know, one of those two, I think they're going to have to get themselves much more involved in the game in that role than they've been able to so far for us to kind of break down what's going to be a really difficult Sheffield United, well-drilled Sheffield United shape to get through.
Mm. And I think this is going to be the first game where we're not playing a team who's going to high press. So that should be really interesting in terms of our build-up play, because we've been quite critical of the build-up play in the last two games. But obviously both teams that we played against were trying to close down our build-up play. I don't think Sheffield United are going to try and do that so much. So I think we should get a little bit more time and space on the ball in the central midfield areas. So it'll be interesting to see if there's any blowback from that. Tom, what about yourself?
Yeah, I mean, it will be won and lost in the midfield, I think, whichever team takes control of it. And obviously the centre-backs, because I think we're going to have to look out for counters from them. And it feels like it's going to be a really tight game. Like, I don't think there'll be many goals, despite all our cavalier football so far. So, it's going to be... The things I'm really interested by in Sheffield United is that they've signed Ollie Burke, who is a winger, I think, mostly, but they're playing him at centre forward. And that seems like a really interesting evolution of their tactics to sign this essentially incredibly fast player to play up front, because hardly any teams have the luxury of playing with a front two where you can play a player like that up front, just like someone who's just really fucking quick, basically. I think it's a possibly really good value signing for Sheffield United, because it might be that he could work as a striker in that system better than he could work in any other position in any other system.
Yeah, agreed. One thing we haven't actually mentioned is, with the man-marking system, is who takes the overlapping centre-back when they go forward? Is it going to be... And this is something, again, I noticed from watching the game back, is that Bamford was just coming back loads against Sheffield United. And I think, you know, we all know that teams who have centre-backs who run into midfield cause us problems. Sheffield United have got two centre-backs who are going to be essentially playing as wingers at times. And I guess I'm kind of interested to see how we deal with that in terms of the man-marking system, because there has to be some sort of flexibility because we have that inferiority up front. So we'll have two players pressing three. So, yes, there's going to be a stay-at-home centre-back, but there's always... No one is technically marking, man-marking one of the either of the outside centre-backs. And so the question is going to be, how do you keep them under control?
I almost wonder, would it be possible to have the two wingers on the centre-backs and Bamford instead would alternate between the main centre-back and the defensive midfielder?
Yeah.
Like, as that being his job rather than worrying about the outside centre-backs.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I'm just trying to think of... Then you've got their wing-backs, so I suppose you put your wing-backs on their wing-backs, which would change the sort of system of 3-3-1-3 that we've been playing. And leave the inside centre-back, the centre centre-back, to his own devices and have, Bamford dropping in on Sander Berger or Ollie Norwood, depending on who it is. It may be the case that even that we start with Rodrigo as the striker, but I don't think that's that likely, given that we kind of have a personnel issue in terms of other spaces. So I would imagine that Bamford gets played as the striker. But yeah, it'd be interesting to see if Bamford does sit a bit deeper with the two wingers ahead of him anyway, because that gives you a really nice way of decompressing anyway if you're under pressure, and we'll obviously be quite dangerous on the counter-attack. Right, with all that said, how do we expect the game to unfold on Saturday, Tom?
Yeah, as I said, I don't think there'll be many goals. I think it's going to be very tight. And this feels like it's going to be a bit more like one of our, despite the fact that we just played Fulham, a bit more like one of our Championship games against one of the best teams in the Championship. And I don't say that out of disrespect to Sheffield United, more that it feels like it'll be two teams going at it, but with slightly different philosophies, in that I imagine we'll probably have a bit more of the ball. Yeah. It's just going to be awful, as it always is. I'm going to be sat there, I'm going to be mostly stood up, pacing the room, cursing every time anyone opens the door because there's a draft. Just getting annoyed all the time. It's going to be awful.
Are you a proper Yorkshire dad, Tom? Shut that fucking door!
In that way only.
How about you, Dan?
I agree with everything that Tom said. I think it's going to be really hard for... I think although Sheffield United are... You know, they've got the ability to play creatively and quite well. I think actually they're quite attritional in the Premiership, and I think it's going to be a really tough game for us to get through. But I do think we'll come out of it with a hard fought close win.
Well, there you have it. That's the All Stats Aren't We preview of the Sheffield United game. We will be back on Monday with a review episode. Hopefully we'll have lots of good things to say. Housekeeping stuff: if you like our podcast and you want to get more of our content, head over to All Stats Aren't We on Twitter and see what we've got going on over there, although maybe leave it a few days till things are quietened down. If even after that you still want more of our content, we do have a Patreon, which is a subscription service which allows you to get bonus content that isn't available free to our other listeners. So if that interests you, well, we've just had a video go up on Monday looking back at the Fulham game, breaking it down tactically with match of the day style annotations on the video and commentary on that. We've also put a podcast up today about set pieces, which I believe Darren enjoyed.
I did very much, yeah. I thought it was really, really excellent. You should all buy it immediately.
If that does sound interesting to you, head over to our Patreon at www.patreon.com/allstatsaren't we, and have a look at what we've got going on over there. Three people who've done that recently are Charlie Hunter, Alan Ebbs, and Neil. So thank you guys for joining us. And that means we're at the end of this podcast. So all that's left for me to do is to say thank you, Darren.
Cheers.
And thank you, Tom.
Of course.
And hopefully we will beat those blades.
Have it.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.